SBS live streams and podcasts are supported by advertising.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.
SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yaman, welcome to NITV Radio. Bertrand Tungandami Ngaya. I am Bertrand Tungandami. Coming up in your program this Monday, the 22nd of July, we have current affairs stories from a First Nations perspective brought to us by NITV's NOLA program. We also present a new album, Bolamidong, an inspiring collection of original songs, contemporary and retold stories written and nurtured on New Inland by First Nations young people, communities and guests up and down the New South Wales south coast from Eden to Nowra. And in Western Sydney, advocates have convened to address the escalating prevalence of diabetes among First Nations communities. All these stories and more coming to you after the latest news.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
This bulletin, the ACCC discontinues investigation into white hands on black art allegations. US President Joe Biden withdraws from the presidential race. And multiple investigations underway into Carlton rail tragedy that killed a father and his toddler. Australian Consumer and Competition and Consumer Commission has discontinued its investigation into the APY Arts Centre Collective, saying it found nothing to suggest consumer law had been breached. In April, the group of Indigenous-owned art centres was accused of allowing non-Aboriginal assistants paint elements of works about the Tjukurpa sacred spiritual beliefs and laws. A video appeared to show a non-Aboriginal person directing the painting of work by artist Yariji Young, who has denied her art was interfered with. A panel commissioned by the South Australian government is still investigating the allegations. The collective have welcomed the findings made by the commission. The family of a First Nations woman fatally shot by police in Western Australia 5 years ago says an inquest has provided some answers but not eased their suffering. Yamaji woman Jessie was holding a knife when she was shot in Geraldton Street in September 2019 by then Constable Brent Windham. The 29-year-old mother had previously been diagnosed with drug-induced psychosis and schizophrenia. Constable Windham was charged and later found not guilty of murder and manslaughter. Her death and the court case sparked widespread protests. An inquest into Jessie's death has wrapped up, and her family says more mental health services will help prevent a similar tragedy in the future.
They let her down, they failed her, and then they just don't like how they speak of her when it came to her mental disorder. If she had a mental disorder, they should have helped her. not let her struggle. She needed help.
Give somebody that's in mental health to go with the police, or go themselves first and then with the police. Or even if the police go and they on standby.
The coroner's findings will be handed down at a later date. U.S. President Joe Biden has announced he's withdrawing as the Democratic candidate in the country's upcoming presidential election. His decision to step aside, announced in a letter posted to social media, came after Democrats spoke out in increasing numbers to voice concerns over the 81-year-old's mental acuity and ability to win the face-off with Republican rival Donald Trump. President Biden posted on Twitter, "It has been the greatest honor of my life to serve as your president." Some voters, like Gerard Keene of Arizona, welcomed the news.
I think at this point everyone seemed to think it was inevitable, and I think it was the right call on his part. And I think going forward we're all kind of excited for what's coming next.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has thanked Biden for his leadership and service as president. Mr. Albanese says he respects his decision to withdraw from the race for another term in office.
As he's done throughout his entire time in public life, he has acted in what he considers to be the best interests of the United States of America. He is someone who in January will be able to retire from public life with an extraordinary record.
Former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has also commented, telling the ABC President Biden has made the right decision.
Look, he's made a really tough decision, a brave decision, but it's definitely the right decision. Biden's had a very, very successful presidency. He's achieved an enormous amount. But going into this election, his biggest vulnerability was his age and perceptions that he, was no longer up to the job. So he's done the right thing in stepping back. And I think that's why it's being universally welcomed.
Donald Trump quickly reacted to President Joe Biden's announcement that he will drop out of the 2024 White House race with a post on Truth Social blasting President Biden for being not fit to serve as president. Mr. Trump posted, "Crooked Joe Biden was not fit to run for president and is certainly not fit to serve and never was. He only attained the position of president by lies, fake news and not leaving his basement. All those around him, including his doctor and the media, knew that he wasn't capable of being president, and he wasn't." End of quote. Mr. Trump's campaign did not immediately respond to a request for comment on Mr. Biden's decision to leave the race. Multiple investigations are underway into the deaths of a father and daughter at a train station as the girl's surviving twin leaves hospital. The 2-year-old girl was heard crying from under a train after emergency services arrived at Carlton Railway Station in Sydney's south yesterday afternoon. She and her twin sister were in a pram that rolled and fell onto the tracks, prompting their father to try to save the pair from an oncoming train. The surviving toddler fell between the tracks and was taken to St. George Hospital with her 39-year-old mother, both of whom were in a stable condition. The pair have since been discharged. The girl's 40-year-old father and twin sister both died at the scene. New South Wales Premier Chris Minns says police responded within minutes and rescued one toddler.
2 to 3 minutes after a 000 call was made, New South Wales police were on scene and were able to grab one of the survivors, a young girl, a 2-year-old, from the scene and keep her safe and out of harm's way.
Residents of the Gaza Strip are welcoming a meeting that took place between Fatah and Hamas in China over the weekend, calling for genuine reconciliation and unity among Palestinians. The reconciliation talks in Beijing are seen as crucial for resolving the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Hamas governs Gaza, while Fatah controls part of the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Their rivalry has persisted since the 2006 Palestinian legislative elections. China is leveraging its relationships with various Palestinian factions to foster unity amidst ongoing political tensions and a severe humanitarian crisis. Amjad Shawa is director of the Palestinian NGOs network.
China has a good relationship with various Palestinian parties. We hope that through these efforts undertaken by China to bring together Palestinian forces and factions, especially the Fatah and Hamas movements, an agreement will be reached to end the political division, especially in these difficult circumstances and this unprecedented humanitarian catastrophe.
A Lebanese photojournalist severely wounded during an Israeli strike on South Lebanon carried the Olympic torch in Paris on Sunday to honor journalists injured and killed in the field. The torch relay, which began in May, includes about 10,000 participants from various backgrounds and will culminate at the Games opening ceremony on the 26th of July. Christina Assi of Agence France-Presse was among six journalists hit by Israeli shelling on the 13th of October while covering clashes between Israeli troops and Hezbollah. The attack killed Reuters videographer Issam Abdallah and left Ms. Assi severely injured, resulting in the amputation of part of her leg.
I wish Assam was here to see this, and I wish what happened today wasn't just because we were struck by two rockets. I wish I was able to do this and honor and represent journalists while walking and in my best health.
And into sport, a former AFL club doctor has been banned again for prescribing steroids while he was already suspended for handing out dodgy scripts. Former Western Bulldogs team doctor Richard Vucinic was banned from practicing medicine for 2 years and 6 months by the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal. Vucinic worked with the Bulldogs VFL team as a part-time doctor between 2013 before he was sacked in 2014. The ban comes after he pleaded guilty to and was convicted in August 2022 of prescribing anabolic steroids and benzodiazepines to 13 different patients while he was under another suspension in 2015. The Medical Board of Australia says he also impersonated another doctor to issue prescriptions in what they described as a premeditated conduct for his own personal gain. And now having a look at the weather around the country this Monday, Broome, sunny 31 degrees, Perth, showers increasing 20, Adelaide, partly cloudy 17, Melbourne, a shower or two, easing 17, Hobart, a shower or two, 15, Albury, Wodonga, cloudy 13, Canberra, partly cloudy 14, Wollongong, mostly sunny 19, Sydney, much the same, 20 degrees, Newcastle, sunny 20, Brisbane, also sunny 21, Townsville, sunny 24, Cairns, partly cloudy 26, Alice Springs, sunny 21, Darwin, same forecast and a top of 30 degrees, and the Torres Strait Islands, a cloudy day ahead and a top of 28 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
I'm Bertrand Tungandame and you're listening to NITV Radio, broadcasting from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Monday afternoon. Still to come in your program today, we'll discover a new album, Bulamidong, an inspiring collection of original songs, contemporary and retold stories, written and nurtured on New Inland by First Nations young people, communities and guests up and down the New South Wales South Coast from Aden to Nowra. Also in the program, in Western Sydney, advocates have convened to address the escalating prevalence of diabetes among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. But first, some current affairs stories shared with us by NITV's NOLA program. History has been made in Victoria with the state's Indigenous representative body formally declaring it is ready to begin negotiations with the government on a statewide treaty. In a ceremony last week, the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria gave its declaration to the new independent treaty umpire, with those present acknowledging the generations of activism and work that led them to this point. Cameron Gully reports.
A message imprinted on a kangaroo skin, bearing a nation-leading declaration. Victoria's First Peoples Assembly is finally ready to negotiate treaty.
Our journey towards equality and justice is deeply rooted in a long history of Aboriginal activism in Victoria. And over generations, our people have collectively marched and protested for our rights, and today we continue that fight.
The declaration was given to members of the new Independent Treaty Authority at the organisation's official launch today. It opened with a smoking ceremony and a performance by young dancers. The gathering was also graced with an emotional performance from renowned musician Uncle Kutcha Edwards. And the Treaty Authority had its own gift to exchange with the Assembly, a shield. The Authority's chair emphasising the importance of treaty in forging a new future for First Nations people.
There is a gaping wound that has not been healed in this country. We deserve to prosper, and the people of Victoria deserve to have strong Aboriginal communities.
The Assembly saying a statewide treaty needs to give community real power over decisions made about them.
We're very much focused on some structural reform to make sure that decision-making of government about First Peoples can be transferred to First Peoples, that we can hold government accountable, and that we can provide direct advice to government.
The state of Victoria is enthusiastic about coming to the negotiating table with First Peoples because we know that when First Peoples thrive, all of Victoria thrives.
It's been 6 years since Australia's very first treaty legislation was passed here at Victoria's Parliament. Having taken this next historic step today, the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria will begin community consultation, with hopes that the state government will be ready to begin negotiations by November.
We encourage all Victorians to follow along with the First Peoples Assembly, see what's happening, find out the information, and join us on this journey.
A generation-spanning journey that may finally have its destination in sight. Cameron Gooley, NITV News.
Traditional owners are hoping to share a Tiwi Island delicacy with the world. The Manti Yupi clan are part of a world-first trial in black lip oyster farming, which they want to take to a global market in the next 2 years. NITV's Emma Kellaway travelled to see the farms in Waramianga in the Tiwi Islands.
Hunting on the water is a natural way of life here on the Tiwi Islands.
Been growing up eating them oysters, all the bush food, yeah, from the sea, yeah. Like oysters, turtle, digong, yeah, fish, crab, lots of things in the sea.
For the Manti Yupi clan, they're looking for new ways of harvesting traditional foods, starting with the black lip oyster.
Chip him off the reef, yeah, and for us to get them black lip oyster, it's good, you know, for people and how to see different thing growing. Yeah.
It's a delicacy that grows wild on rocks fringing the two main islands of Melville and Bathurst. Now they're being farmed in cages floating offshore where the crocodile populations are high and dangerous.
Yeah, crocodile, a lot of saltwater everywhere.
The green algae, a key element in the oyster diet, is abundant in these waterways. Twice a fortnight, they are flipped to dry and inspected for new growth. The hatchery production is critical to the process. Currently done out of a lab in Darwin, researchers collect spawn from wild oysters, feeding them on a formula of algae until they're big enough to release.
I think that having a product that has a provenance, it's grown on country by traditional owners in a remote destination in the Northern Territory, is a fabulous story.
The Tiwi Islands is one of four top-end communities with trials underway, work supported by Commonwealth and NT government grants, but with hopes of taking the blacklip oyster to a global market in 2 years, more investment is needed before the project wraps in 2026.
Hope will grow and we can send them in Darwin all over the global, you know, and they can have a taste of our oyster that grows from our water.
Better for them kids, you know, learn about the oysters, you know, be great, you know, for them little ones growing up in the future.
In Warramayunga, Emma Kellaway, NITV News.
A Torres Strait Islander campaigner is calling on all Pacific nations to unite in the fight against climate change. Speaking at the recent 13th Festival of Pacific Arts and Culture in Hawaii, Yesi Mosby said coming together is the only way smaller island nations will be heard. Carla Grant has more.
Yesi Mosby is determined to see results in the war against climate change in the Pacific. He's already seen the devastating effects on his homeland, Marsig Island, in the Torres Strait.
Within the last 2 years, we've lost 3 metres of land. It affects our traditional way of practice and the way of living.
Speaking at the recent FESPAC gathering in Hawaii, Yesi is encouraging Indigenous peoples in the Pacific region to think about other island nations in their pursuit of climate justice.
Nothing has been heard now because they're moving singly. If they all come together and join, that's what we're asking for, to come and join us.
Yesi knows that victory is possible. In 2022, he and a group of seven others from the Torres Strait Islands successfully lodged a complaint against the Australian government to the United Nations Human Rights Council.
It set a precedent throughout the world, knowing that a lot of other islands and other Indigenous people will eat the fruit of this labour, that they will seek, you know, climate justice for their home.
Despite their win at the UN, the Torres Strait Eight never received financial compensation. Instead, the federal government invested the funds into climate research.
If you ask me personally, I would have want the money to go to, you know, help in seawall or the coral bleaching, not to come up with another little organisation that they're going to, you know, just going to fly around and study climate change. Climate change is real.
Yesi is now calling on the government to come and see for themselves the real threat his homeland faces.
The government cannot make no decision in the comfort of their couches and in their offices. They really need to come home, come to the Torres Strait, and sit with grassroots people.
Carla Grant, NITV News.
And that's all for the stories shared with us by NITV's NOLA program, a current affairs program that specializes in current affairs from a First Nations perspective. We must now go to a break, but stay tuned, because when we come back, we discover a new album, Bala Midong, an album with a collection of stories, old and new, from the southern coast of New South Wales. Stay tuned.
Visit sbs.com.au/NITV Radio.
And that was Standing Strong by the Younger Warriors. Coming up next, we discover a new album, Bala Midong, an inspiring collection of original songs, contemporary and retold stories written and nurtured on New England by First Nations young people, communities and their guests up and down the New South Wales coast from Aden to Nowra.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Bala Midong is an album of original songs and stories created as a legacy piece to a 3-year intercultural project between schools, communities, cultural leaders, South Coast musicians and leading arts and social change organization Big Heart. And to get some insights into this groundbreaking album, I'm joined by Gabriela Green-Lonea and Warren Foster,
aka Prodigal One. But thanks for joining us and welcome to Night TV Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
I'll start with a question that can be addressed to any of the two of you. Take us through the making of this album, because I gather it's a multi-year project. It's not something that just came up like that. It's been a long time coming.
It's been an amazing process to get to the album launch, like, and to get to the album being out there now. You know, we started, 2 years ago, maybe three, and I think it was like 2 years ago we started working in the communities, trying to develop different shows for the three different communities. So down in Eden, at Wallinga Lake, and then up in Nara. So, you know, putting on events and performances for the young people within those communities. But then, yeah, so that developed into a you know, bigger thing. So we went on putting we put on a massive show that involved like storytelling, telling stories of the old Dreamtime stories that's been passed down. We used singing and songwriting and then dancing, you know, working with the young people within community, just give them an opportunity to experience, you know, what it is to put on a show and put a show together and even be recorded and put on an album and on, you know, on all platforms and stuff like that.
Yeah. You work on different platforms, you play different genres of music, and you've wowed audiences right across the country. How is it like working with the youth from these small communities?
I always see myself within the young people and within the kids of community, often because they're family, but also, yeah, I just see myself because I was one of those young people, you know? And, yeah, I'm always thankful for the people that come to community to teach me and to inspire me to do the many different things that I do. But it all started from dancing and stuff with my father, like Warren Costa Senior. That's where the dancing and culture comes from. And then and the music comes from him as well. From me traveling, doing that there to, you know, having the opportunity to teach young people and kids of my community and all my nephews and nieces to, like, you know, teach them a bit of music and a bit of singing or even just dancing and telling stories that I've been told. You know, because they're the stories of who we are and where we come from as a people.
Yeah.
As a community.
I think it's also great, like, having all the different art forms, because it just allows, like, so many people to participate as well. I don't think this album would have been the album it was if it wasn't for the dancing and the storytelling. And even we did, like, you know, we designed skateboards, so it's so multidisciplinary, and I think that just really allows for kids to kind of engage in so many different ways and have a say in what, you know, in a way that feels comfortable for them, but then still be a part of the bigger picture. So, like, the lyrics of the song, you know, talked about the Dreamtime stories that we learned, and also, you know, there's a line about an eagle flying over us, and that happened every time we did a dance outside. We had an eagle fly on top of above us before we danced every single time. So it's all these kind of little experiences that come from different parts of the journey that kind of come to this song and to this album.
So, yeah, the outdoor shows were a lot different than the indoor, like, well, to the album launch. The three communities, like, Eden worked super hard, like, Brother Nathan Ligon down there worked super hard with the young people, and they had done an amazing job and, like, put on an amazing outdoor performance as well as, as well as recording. So it was amazing, the Eden crew. And then us at Wallinga, working with all the young people from the community was something else. But even working with the older fellas, like Uncle Raj and Dad, as the Wallinga dance there, and our song on that there is, it's amazing. You know, Brother Nookie played it on his show. It was mad as.
Yeah, so it became really, even though it began with a youth focus, the whole communities got involved and it did become, you know, quite an intergenerational project.
The launch, which was in Shoalhaven, is described as something really magic. You said it's different from other appearances that you've made throughout the region. Can you give us a little bit more insight into how the launch, how the magic moment of launching this album was already a little bit less than a month ago, actually?
Because the show has been developing over so long, and like we've put on the free performances, outdoor performances in a different community, was unsure like how the live show of the album is going to go in the process of it. Yeah. So we were developing it with all the people on, like with all the community mentors and stuff, and the cultural mentors within the three different communities and the different teachers and stuff.
Yeah.
So with all of us coming together and developing it, and we was like, yeah, because I was still unsure how many people was going to come.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden,
like once we finally did get there, it was, yeah, I was blown away. It was one of the greatest experiences ever, you know? And especially like bringing the young people from Wallaga Lake and, you know, my nephews and nieces up, and little cousins to come and, you know, little brothers to experience such a big stage like the Shoalhaven Entertainment Centre. No, there's not many words that can describe it. Like, there's 1,000 words that can describe it, but I can't find them all right now. It was just so special, and yeah, it meant so much to me just to spend that time with everyone who came, with all the band members, all the different people that helped us, like Gabby and like all the crew, and even just all the young people that was involved in the making of it.
It says that this whole process involved workshops in local First Nations languages, involve different shows and art practices, including digital art film, filmmaking and songwriting, and all this in a culturally safe environment, which is really, really very powerful. Can you run us through those projects? Maybe give us some hint of how this came together and how you work together.
Yeah, so basically, I think what was really important to keep kind of culture strong and at the forefront is just really engaging with like First Nation artists from those areas.
Yeah.
First Nations artists that are really, you know, kind of excelling and doing great stuff in what they do. And yeah, so they're not only just sharing like the skill sets in these different art forms, but they're also, you know, they're finding that strong sense of identity and able to sort of really have a strong connection to place where the art's being made. And so there's this, yeah, really beautiful response. And you kind of see it in all the songs, place becomes a really strong, is this kind of similar theme throughout. And then it's a beautiful connection also. So we have like a real kind of local First Nations led. Also, we had lots of visiting kind of mentors and different artists that brought different skill sets, you know, through the Big Heart team, which then allowed kind of those new skills to be learned. So, for example, like in the digital drawing space, and we had April Phillips, she's a Wiradjuri woman. She helped at that kind of beginning of that digital drawing space. But then, you know, we also had Scott Baker and lots of other Savan and Sid Green, like they all bring their different art forms, whether that's in recording music or songwriting or projection and digital drawing and music production as well. So you've got a real community-led process, and then all these kind of extra skills that come in as well that just really allow everyone to kind of do new things and try new.
Yeah, the biggest thing with all those different projects was allowing opportunity for different kids to experience, you know, and for the kids to experience actually, just because they could see something coming out of that there in the future. Mm-hmm. So they could aspire to maybe a different art practice or performance, you know, just through those different avenues that and did different projects that we did put on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was just about like given opportunity and experience to, you know, try new stuff. You know, there was a lot of amazing artists and like photographers and even amazing musicians and stuff.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's a lot like back in the old days, like within the tribes and within communities, everyone has a role to play, you know? Everyone tells a story in their own ways. Some paint the pictures, some sing the songs, and some dance the dances. That's all I want, you know?
And I believe some are just there to just encourage the youth, because when you have some heavyweights coming together, youth will just come because they're attracted to these big figures to come and watch their heroes and the people they admire and actually maybe follow. I think that would be also great to have heavyweights like yourselves interacting with young kids.
That was the biggest part, like the best part with the mentors within the community. Like Gab said, like, they had some great mentors that are achieving some amazing stuff, you know, and working with those mentors that are, you know, doing so much work with the young people within schools and stuff already and doing so much to bring back culture strong within community makes it so much more stronger as well.
You're one of the cultural mentors, but you also perform and you're particularly involved in several tracks like Sticks and Stones, King Merriman, We Are One. Can you tell us one or two words about these particular tracks?
They're mad. Like, you know, I love them. Performing and working on these tracks was something else because it was so organic and it just come. It'll come from the story of Sticks and Stones, which is a sacred creation story of the first woman and the first man, Ngadi Ntunku. So a lot of our stories at Wallaga and a lot of what we do, because we live under Gulaga Mountain, that's where a lot of our Dreamtime stories come from and start. So telling that their story, sharing it to the young people, and then also putting it on the album was a dream.
Yeah.
You know, showing people the culture that we have here in the South Coast is the best thing that we could ask for. And even showing our own community, you know, this is a lot of the stuff that we still have. And this is for years to learn and teach in the future.
Yeah. Now, before I let you go, maybe I'll open the mic to you for final thoughts, maybe where this whole project is going from where you started, where the journey so far, and going forward, what's in stock for us?
Well, the album's on, like, you can hear the album, so it's on Spotify and iHeart and all other digital music kind of stream platforms. So that's, you know, something if you haven't heard the songs, definitely encourage everyone to have a listen. And, yeah, hopefully we can, you know, get the groups back together and continue these workshops. And, you know, I think the show really and the album launch really left us at a real high. And I think, you know, all the communities, all the young people and all the artists are really keen to kind of see what we can come up next. Maybe it's taking the show on the road or, yeah, continuing these sort of, yeah.
Yeah. The kids and all the mentors have already been asking, like, well, what are we going to do now? Like, you know, what's the plan now? And the kids, like, they was on such a high. They want to do more of, like, this stuff. You know, being on stage with such a big band, a lot of the kids were asking, like, the next projects you do, could you teach us how to play instruments and stuff? So they want to learn how to play instruments. So now that they've seen, like, been on stage and done that there, we hope to, you know, that's going to be our next projects, I think, with them. So we may get some instruments and stuff for them and then teach them how to play some music.
And maybe take some cameras, get them to shoot their own videos and all that. So that they become just multi-talented like yourselves, really.
That's the plan from now, you know. Like, that was the first experience for them. But now it's, you know, giving them the skills and further taking their aspirations and, you know, inspirations to show people, you know, and help them achieve goals and dreams that they aspire to and be the people they aspire to be.
Excellent.
The album, like, the album is, I hope we can take it on the road. You know, that live show was one of the best experiences I ever had. You know, as an MC, like, leading the show along to also, you know, all them laughs and all them good times. Just take that to other places, it would be something else.
Yeah.
But yeah, make sure you all check it out on Spotify and Heart. Yeah.
Keep us posted. Keep us posted. We'd really like to cover your journey across the country. So stay in touch and we'd be really, really pleased to have you on air again to talk about this exciting project. Well, Cabrera Green-Olea and Warren Foster, thank you very much for joining us on ITV Radio today.
Thank you, brother. Enjoy Bulamitang album. Yeah, yeah.
I will. Thanks a lot.
Visit sbs.com.au/NITV Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Bertrand Tungandame, and you're listening to NITV Radio, coming to you from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Monday afternoon. Now, in Western Sydney, community leaders have convened to address the escalating prevalence of diabetes among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. Highlighting success stories and urgent needs, advocates pushed for enhanced access to affordable diabetes management technologies amid health disparities and systemic challenges. Kabita Kinasho reports.
68-year-old Auntie Maureen has been living with type 2 diabetes for around 2 decades.
My doctor was saying if I kept doing what I was doing, which was basically nothing, I may have ended up on insulin.
A proud Wiradjuri woman from Leeton in New South Wales, she now lives in Western Sydney and last year joined the Too Deadly for Diabetes program, which helps Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities tackle diabetes through diet and exercise.
Dropped from 86 kilos to 67. My sugars were 15. To 6 this morning, and I've gone from 4 diabetes tablets and medication down to 1.
Success stories like Auntie Maureen's have been shared at a community event in Western Sydney to raise awareness about the alarming rise of diabetes diagnoses. Ray Kelly is a diabetes researcher, exercise physiologist, and a proud Gomeroi man, an advocate for the use of continuous glucose monitors, the latest in diabetes monitoring devices. He says continuous glucose monitors, or CGMs, allow those living with diabetes to be more aware of what is going on with their blood sugar level and how what they do affects it.
The technology around diabetes care has just made a phenomenal improvement to our program. So we were already getting great outcomes. But by the use of, say, continuous glucose monitors, CGMs by patients, it allows them to get a great understanding of how food and exercise impacts their blood sugar levels. And by doing that, it motivates them. They know that they get a sense of control. And so it makes it easier for us to get better goals in terms of weight loss, blood glucose level control, but also reduction in medications.
But diabetes rates are rising. Mr. Kelly explains why and what needs to be done.
Because of a combination of access to health care, the cost of fresh food, the sort of misinformation that's around through social media, but also just through some organisations around what can be achieved. And it's only really been the last few years that remission of type 2 diabetes has really been accepted across the board. But we've been doing that for 15, 20 years. So, it's about getting everyone working together, all the key stakeholders, supporting people, working with the individual and setting them up for the goals they want to achieve.
The latest data shows 40% of Aboriginal adults in remote Central Australia are living with diabetes. That's the highest recorded diabetes prevalence in the world. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples are also experiencing the highest rates of youth-onset diabetes in the world. Deanne Minikin is an adjunct associate professor and the Diabetes Australian National Manager for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Engagement. She says if not managed, diabetes gets worse and worse and puts a person's life at risk by their 30s.
We're looking at kids that are being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes at the age of 4.
So then the risk of complications from that is then extended to when they're teenagers, they're having diabetes. By the time they're 20s, there could potentially be complications like blindness or amputations, those sorts of things. By the time of the 30s, there's risk of losing lives.
The event is also highlighting calls to increase affordable access to diabetes management technologies. 18-year-old Malachi monitors his blood sugar levels and takes insulin through wearable devices that have changed his life. He uses a CGM and an insulin pump, which measures the dose he needs.
With the prick test, you would have to do about 5 to 7 times a day, and usually around about 2 hours, every 2 hours. And then when you do it too many times with a certain finger, your fingers start to become bruised and hardened and all of that. So that was the reason why I got switched from the prick test into the liquid sensor.
Malachi says there has been a significant decrease in the number of times he's needed to visit a hospital. He says there have been 5 times where he nearly died. He's been to the hospital 30 times. But since receiving the CGM and insulin pump 2 years ago, he has never needed to go to hospital. But this technology is not cheap. Advocates are calling on the federal government for funding to improve access to these technologies. CGMs are currently only subsidised for type 1 diabetes, but have proven to be effective for those living with type 2 and other types of diabetes. Justine Kane is CEO of Diabetes Australia.
It can be up to $5,000 a year to have access to a CGM. If you don't have subsidies, even more in some cases, depending on, you know, sometimes they come off and you have to replace them. So it's like, that's an issue. We also have a situation where for pumps, only top health cover, so gold health cover, covers insulin pumps. Now, we know in this cost of living crisis, families can't afford these things. I have people telling me, parents telling me, that they're giving up their car insurance, their house insurance, they're stopping having any takeaway, they're not going out at all to access these types of subsidies.
Gabrielle Catenaccio, SBS News.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
And that's all from us on NITV Radio this Monday afternoon. I'm Bertrand Tungandame, thanking you for being with me this afternoon. Our next program is on Wednesday, same time. Leaving you with a Shed Away by Electric Fields.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.